When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show, Monday through on the Athletic Podcast Network. This is Nerder, She Wrote with your host, Dave Dufour.
With Mo DeKeel.
Are you ready to be entertained?
And Seth Partnow.
Hello and welcome to the Athletic NBA Show. It's Friday. I'm Dave Dufour, and that means it's Nerder, She Wrote. Those voices that you heard on the other side, that's Seth and Mo. What's up, guys? Welcome back.
What's up, Dave?
I can't contain myself.
We've been laughing too hard in the pre-show. We're too ready. Man, the playoff, the first round, almost over. The Nerder series, of course, which has been the dumbest series to watch. The only one that's still left. Hey, look, have you guys seen two dumber teams play against each other and had it be this fun?
Memphis hasn't struck me as a dumb team all year. I think that they have gotten sucked into the vortex of Minnesota.
It's chaos.
Yeah.
Yes and no. The Jaren Jackson foul issue has always been a thing, and that's just kind of got highlighted by adding more stupidity to the other side.
Can I drop my stat again here? I've tweeted about this. Recognizing the reasons why Memphis doesn't want to play Steven Adams in this series. This season, Jaren Jackson, when he was playing on the floor with Steven Jackson, averaged 3.9 fouls per 36 minutes. In the minutes he played without Steven Jackson, he averaged 5.4 fouls per 36 minutes and roughly even amounts of minutes in both. And I think that, you know, they want to get to that Jackson at five lineup, but they can't do it all game. What ends up happening is Jackson plays 20 minutes, and that's bad for them.
This is one of the reasons why I thought they went too quickly away from Steven Adams. I think they had to maybe cut down his minutes. They were getting good stuff from Brandon Clark and things like that. But I felt like to just go from he starting game one to we ain't seeing him again was a bit extreme from Jenkins. I thought that was probably too much there, but like you need to find a little bit of a happy medium, even if it's a ceremonial start for 10 minutes.
And now
you know, you got to kind of do that.
He's out, right? He's in the protocols, so not even an option for game seven. So, game six, excuse me. Let's be honest. It's got to go seven. I felt the same way about Sixers Raptors, but basketball gods wouldn't give it to us.
We were all hoping for that for Sixers Raptors.
The narrative's all lined up so hard on everyone being ready for it to go to game seven, and everyone had their knives sharpened, Mo.
And so I threw my knife before game six. Go read my article on Bleacher Report. I was smart. I said, let me get in ahead of everybody.
And you know, we can't have nice things, so of course it didn't go seven.
Well, we can have nice things because we always have our favorite things. This is how we start the show. And guys, this week, my favorite thing is bees. Rudy Gobert apparently is a beekeeper. I love it. He got stung on the nose, which I'm a dog owner. I think most dog owners, if you take your dog outside, you've experienced this at some point in your life. Rudy Gobert looked like my English bulldog the one time he ate a bumblebee. It's amazing. It's a great photo. But I thought that Rudy's quote about it was really good. He said, there's a few things. It's good for the environment. It's good for the landscape, the flowers, the fruits. And I love honey, so I always wanted to have my own. It's great. Sometimes there's some casualties. This is great. This is my favorite thing. There's no bit there to it. I love Rudy Gobert, beekeeper. That's it.
Seth, are you surprised by this?
Which part of it are you asking me from?
Dave with the beekeeping. I don't even care about the Rudy Gobert part. I'm almost now just half expecting Dave. I can see Dave in the whole beekeeping outfit.
I think Dave probably has a like a hive in a portable hive in the back of his van. So when he's on his road trips, he just brings the bees with him.
Listen, man, I have a dream that involves a couple of hives and a couple of apple trees. That's, you know, I'm a simple man. I don't want a lot in life. Just give me those things. All right, Mo, what's your favorite thing this week?
Yeah, my favorite thing, also slightly silly, but Draymond Green bouncing passes off of people's heads. We know how great of a passer he is, but he's giving out concussions. Klay Thompson, Otto Porter Jr., both of them getting knocked out. TNT had a great bit. You know, they put the animated hard hat on those guys as well, like to be ready for. Yeah, man, Draymond, these are hard passes too. Like, they weren't like, oh, haha, funny. Like, both of those guys look dazed.
Well, you know, when you've got Nikola Jokic out there with the way his hands, but you got to throw the ball hard. I'm Team Draymond here. Keep your head on a swivel. You got to be ready.
Seth, okay, man, killing people with concussions. That's right. So okay,
Seth, what's your favorite thing?
You guys went silly. I'm going to go a little earnest. So there's, you know, Dave, you know this. Mo, you hate this. In wrestling, there's sometimes if there's a hard fought match, and like, you know, the aging hero gets defeated or something like that, they get the handshake of respect. And after a hard-fought NBA, like, playoff series, whether it's NBA, football playoff game, NHL series, whatever, I enjoy that when the opposing teams, like, respect the competition that they've just been through. And I think we've seen a couple of examples of that in the last couple of days. Obviously, the number of connections between New Orleans and Phoenix and, you know, Willie Green having worked with everyone and you know, a lot of the people on the New Orleans staff having been on Phoenix's staff last year and so on and so forth. That's really great to see. The other one is, and I feel like this may have like kind of almost changed the MVP narrative a little bit, was the Warriors kind of certified Jokic, just the way they were like, hey, that was five games, but you know, you're real. And I enjoy that. There's so much like, you know, tearing down and shit talking that like, no, that guy's good. Like I like that.
I loved how effusive Draymond was in particular in his praise of Jokic. I mean, I thought that, and I understand that part of that is also he's got to knock the other guys that he's, you know, he's throwing shots at those guys while also building up Jokic. But I did think that you're right. Like, the narrative is switched. I mean, now it helps that Embiid is not looking amazing because of the thumb. But I think when you watch those games and what Jokic was able to do, and everyone's clearly seeing that the talent disparity between those two teams, it was the Grand Canyon in a difference. And yeah, Jokic, he was insane.
I mean, I hate the narrative switch, and I hate when somebody struggles in the playoffs, we start screaming they don't deserve whatever award or whatever. It's a regular season award, folks. Everybody needs to chill the hell out. And you know, like it's the narrative switch of everything. This kind of just proved, like, look what Jokic was able to do with this, you know. And I think that's kind of one of those things. Again, I'm happy with any three of those guys winning the MVP. Whoever wins it, those three deserve it. Unless it's somebody out of right field. If Jalen Brunson wins the MVP all of a sudden, then I'm going to have some questions. But besides that, like, I think we're there. But the narrative switch stuff is just kind of lame.
Well, listen, after the 14 of 14 performance, Chris Paul is clearly the MVP. At least for the Suns in the playoffs. I do want to, before we get to some of the bigger subjects, guys, the Suns and Mavs are a fascinating matchup. And in particular, because their late game stuff is just, it's dissimilar. But they're both really, really playing well down the stretch so far in the playoffs.
I'm not sure
Suns not up to where we usually, like, where we usually see them. But in the last couple games, I did think that they got back to where they're supposed to be.
I sort of, last night especially, I feel like the Mavs got away with it more than whereas last night was sort of a masterclass, and this is what the Suns do at the end of games. Like, they've been winning games, you know, Bridges with the steal and a dunk, Booker with a timely three, and Chris Paul sticking mid-range and, you know, making life miserable for Indy. They ground out 25 professional wins that way this season. Whereas Dallas kind of half tries to hunt a mismatch and dribbles the ball at the top of the key for 20 seconds and throws up a step back. And sometimes they go in, but I just feel like there's so much more of like execution. And I don't want to be like a total like snobby run stuff guy, but Phoenix gets Phoenix gets to their stuff, and Dallas kind of got away from like the stuff that was working for them is, hey, let's put Mitchell's guy in every action. And then the last 4 minutes of the game, it's like, well, we'll come set a pick and roll at the top of the key, and then Luka will dribble for a while. And that's all it did.
The difference is, and this is between the two teams, is there is intent and purpose in what Phoenix is running at the end of games. Like, you can see it in everything. I was doing a playback with Kevin O'Connor. We're doing a watch along, and literally coming out of the timeouts, I said, they're going to hunt CJ McCollum. All they're going to do is set a screen, get CJ McCollum on Chris, and then they'll go to work out of that. Maybe another screen will come or whatever, but they'll just work out of that opportunity. And that's exactly the stuff that starts to happen. With the Mavs, same thing. They are going to hunt, and they're going to go matchup hunting in that regards, but it doesn't seem as purposeful. It doesn't seem as intentful. Like, here's a great way of putting it. The Suns are using a scalpel and the Mavs are using a machete. And I think that's kind of the way I look at it. Same concept. They're both trying to slice, but one's trying to be very precise. And one's just going like, I hope we get it.
Well, to be fair to the Mavs, though, they had a lot more targets, right? Like, yes. It's not like they didn't. There was no Herb Jones out there to avoid.
Or Jose Alvarado.
Or just any sort of passable defender. Let's be honest. I mean, they could go at anybody. And a lot of times, to Seth, to your point, they were settling for that Luka on Gobert. And when Luka was hitting the step back, I mean, it's great. But if the shot doesn't fall, then what? Now, so I'm with you there. Now, I do think the similarities, though, that something we can take away is the way that this Dallas team has grown. And, Mo, we saw something in the first few games from them that we weren't sure if they even had it. Like, without Luka, the fact that they were able to win games, man, this was a massive development for them.
Yeah, I mean, down the stretch, you got to give credit to guys like Jalen Brunson, like Spencer Dinwiddie, like those guys really stepped up in ways that I wasn't necessarily sure they were going to. Even in game one, the game they lost, they were great in that. And again, they almost won that game. Like, and then being able to go into Utah, which, folks, I don't know how many of you understand, that is a very tough place to play. Like, they are on top of you in terms of the fans, the way the arena is set up. Like, they're right on top of you. And for those guys to go in there without Luka, 1-1 series, you're thinking, okay, the Jazz should take it. They come in there and just and go like, nah, we got this, not afraid, and things like that, and had the Jazz on their feet, on their heels for that game. Like, it's just an impressive performance in terms of their growth from those guys, where you're like, wow, that's really something. Like, they're going to be able to win games on the road in the playoffs without Luka. Like, that's a statement there.
Yeah, and we saw Phoenix do that during the season. You know, every time they lost somebody, they just kept on rolling, and then they lost Booker, and it seemed like they were pretty ready for it. I mean, of course, you lose Devin Booker in the playoffs and everything goes out the window, so you have to shuffle and adjust. But Seth, I mean, that's, to me, that's a huge similarity between these two teams now.
I do think that there is Phoenix's guys, I think, are a little more matchup proof. I think we talked about before the series, the Utah series, that, okay, they're without Luka, but this is a good matchup for Jalen Brunson to do well. This is a good matchup for Spencer Dinwiddie to do well. I don't like, you know, going at Mike Conley and Donovan Mitchell is not the same thing as going at Mikal Bridges, yes, and Jay Crowder and Cam Johnson.
Not a lot of target-rich environment. Not a big target-rich environment for them,
like,
in Phoenix.
Like, but, you know, yeah. Jalen Brunson has at times struggled against, like, perimeter size. Utah doesn't have that, which is funny that that's Utah's flaw. No one has ever mentioned that before. But you look at Phoenix, and that's all they have. And so this is a prove it series. You know, you win a game of horse on like a tough shot. It's like, no, make it again. Jalen Brunson, do it again. If you do it again this series, like, all right, whatever the bag is, you're worth it. But yeah, I think that that is – at the same time, though, you do give them credit because the plays were there to be made, but they went out and made them. I want to give – we haven't mentioned one guy, and it's Dorian Finney-Smith. How yep. he is yep. – you know, we sing the praises of Mikal Bridges a lot. Dorian Finney-Smith does a lot of the same things.
Dorian Finney-Smith is, I mean, kind of a perfect wing player right now. And when you look at the way he shoots from the corners, I mean, he's automatic. He's now, you have to guard him. Shooting higher volume, yeah, he's been great. I mean, this contract now looks amazing. Not to be the guy who's only looking at the contract, but wow, to get that guy on, I mean, that's a huge value for them. Crazy.
Remind athlete. Me what his contract is?
It's pretty low. I mean, it's like, I want to say it's $455.
Jeez.
So it's a good value.
That's a great value in that sense, you know, and I think you're right, Seth, in terms of he's kind of gets forgotten a lot and he's so important to that team. Same for Reggie Bullock. Like this is actually a pretty well-built team, to be honest, with what they do. I mean, granted, maybe a little bit short on size in the middle, but maybe that's going to hurt them in this series against Ayton. Maybe they're going to be able to stretch out Ayton and put some pressure on Ayton to have to defend on the perimeter a little bit. And we'll get some answers in that regard. But overall, like kudos to them. Cause I had my questions about this whole thing from front office to the coach. You know, it's listen, year two is always tougher than year one, but like impressed so far with what they've done. And Luka finally gets out of the first round. Well, just didn't have to play the first three games.
And so, it helps, though, that they've got a couple of guys who have sort of broken out. At least one guy who's broken out and a guy who has stepped up. And we're going to talk about some of our favorite guys and our least favorite guys from the playoffs so far after this break.
I'm not putting him on. All right. For him to utter the words F someone out of his mouth lets you know that there's a little bit of hostility there somewhere. The fact that that guy has a vote and that guy who just said F Jalen Green will ultimately have a say if Jalen Green can sign a Supermax deal from the Houston Rockets or not. Like, at some point, and I'm going to say this again, at some point we have to start viewing athletes, NBA players in particular, as businessmen, as guys who understand the business they're in, and stop allowing guys like that to decide the money we make.
I'm Larry Sanders. I'm a person. I'm a father. I'm an artist, a writer, a painter, a musician, and
smoke weed every day.
Okay, guys, so we mentioned a couple of folks that have jumped off the page for us. Dorian Finney-Smith. I'm assuming Jalen Brunson is on everybody's list. But let's talk about this because some guys in the playoffs so far have really just taken a leap, it appears. And I'm going to start with the guy who I think has been the best player in the playoffs so far, Jason Tatum. Both ends of the court, what he's doing offensively with the load and then the job he did on defense, in particular, individual defense against Kevin Durant. Jason Tatum has been on another level in the playoffs.
This has been a couple months, really. Like there was the early part of the season, we talked about this a lot when Boston was scuffling. Like the problem they were having is they have these two wing stars and neither of them were good enough playmakers. I don't know, starting January, February, I don't know what happened, but Jason Tatum has all of a sudden become like a surgeon in the pick and roll, in his ability to find players. And that's just, you know, it may be a subtle thing, but that's just a quantum leap for their growth as a team. Because that means Marcus Smart has to do a little less. Marcus Smart can be a second side playmaker. Marcus Smart can make an open jumper now, and he's getting more of those looks. Robert Williams can get lobs. Al Horford can get open shots. Like Jaylen Brown can get the ball with a closeout coming and really be able to attack going downhill. So I think we're seeing in the playoffs is just a continuation of that, something that's really been brewing for a couple months.
I almost want to go – it went even further along with the defense. You know, there was games in 2020 before the pandemic and the entire world has changed. He was going up against LeBron and holding up LeBron defensively. you know, and doing a good, holding his own defensively against LeBron. He was doing the same thing against Kawhi Leonard with the Clippers in a game in Boston that same time. It's the growth of what we're seeing on both ends of the court. Like, I don't know if we've ever seen this really in this short amount of time in the way, you know, Seth's talking about it. At the start of the year, it was like, God, is this kid ever going to get it? Like, he shows the flashes, but he's going to get it. To now we're like, yo, he's a dude. Like, he's that dude. Like, he's your guy, plain and simple. And I think that's the stuff when you're watching him. I don't disagree with Dave. I think he has been the best player in the playoffs this year. And I think it's not even a debate for me. I don't think we're even close with everything that he's done. And, like, good luck to the Bucks trying to deal with that. And it's on both ends of the court, man. Like, it's been really impressive to watch this.
Without Middleton, I mean, who's – like, it's not – just from a size standpoint, he would have been their best option. And it's just who, like, I don't even know where you start there. We'll get to that.
We're going to talk about that series toward the end of the show. But I do want to just, there have been, I mean, Jalen Brunson. This is, we saw this during the season from him. But to see it on this stage, and now certainly the matchup against Utah is just perfect for Jalen Brunson to just explode. He had 31 points in one of the games and didn't make a three. Okay, I mean, he was just eviscerating them. And he broke down their defense just as much as Luka and created open looks for Dorian Finney-Smith and Maxi Kleber.
I would say he broke their – like, Luka just, like, scored. Like, because he's – like, he is what he is. Like, Brunson actually was, like, you know, breaking their defense down. Like, you know, bullying a guy to the hole, drawing help, kicking. Luka did that at times, but in terms of consistently kind of getting 2 feet in the paint and either making shots or getting open shots for other people. Like, I thought Brunson was even, like, I don't want to say more effective, but as effective as Luka in those terms.
The most impressive thing for me from Jalen Brunson from this series is in the playoffs, he's fourth in points in the paint with 15.3. points a night in the paint. Like, that's the thing that kind of blew me away when I'm watching this series. It's just not just it's and again, part of this is matchup stuff and we understand it, but like getting into the paint and being super effective. And none of this accounts for the kickouts, right? This is just him straight scoring. None of this accounts for him to kick out to leads to the three or the hockey assist that leads to the next pass that's the three. But like, just everything that we're talking about of him breaking down and getting into the paint, it's just super impressive in that thing. And then when you look at that number of just 15.3 points in the paint, that's usually up against their backline defense. That's Rudy. That's Hassan Whiteside. That's, you know, that's, he's not a tall guy. It's any of their wings are all bigger than him. It's along those lines. Like, it was just a very impressive in performance. And this is something we saw coming from him all year, but for him to be able to show he can carry an offense for a couple of games was pretty impressive. Now, I still don't think he's, you know, A1, you should be your number one option. Shout out to a few teams that are sniffing around. I think that's going to be a little bit scary, but I think this is one of those things where it's like he looks perfect in the role he's in, and we're seeing it with what he's doing.
Anybody stand out for you guys?
On a positive side or on a
positive.
Negative side?
Let's go positive first. We'll go negative on the backside. That way, you know,
I mean,
we'll butter people up first.
All hipster team MVP Herb Jones.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I'm just like, I mean, if nothing else, just that the one play where he gets the steal, goes left-handed behind the back and throws in a reverse over like up and around three guys. Just like, you know, like, you know, I don't know if you want to call it hipster or just like, I mean, you guys know that like the type of players who are like my guys, like Herb Jones is like, yeah, a lot of boxes checked there. And he's like, honestly, he's on that. Does he have potential to break out of that, you know, 3-and-D role player like Mikal Bridges is starting to? And, you know, I think we're starting to see Bridges have that little bit more off the bounce that takes him above that level. Does Herb Jones have some of that? I mean, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves because he's, you know, he's a rookie, but.
Of course you're a Herb Jones guy. You're wearing a Herb Jones jersey. People can't see this. I know it's a podcast. But no,
it's over the top of the Kenrich Williams jersey.
Yeah, there's no way to not love Herb Jones and everything he's doing. But the other guy I really kind of like, damn, was Brandon Ingram. You know, like, he's coming in and going, yo, I am an A1 guy. I am a guy you can run your offense through. I can create for others. I can attack in the pick and roll, get downhill and things like that. He showed his fight and willingness to fight, literally telling Chris, you know, we can take this outside or whatever and things like that. But I think there's an impressiveness with that. Like, these were the questions we've had about Brandon Ingram for a long time. Like, is he that dude? Can he be that guy? And like, we saw it in this series. I think, you know, he went toe to toe with those guys in Phoenix. And I think, you know, a lot of the credit goes to Herb Jones and Jose Alvarado because it's fun and fun stories. But this thing's a sweep without Brandon Ingram.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and to be able to hit the mid-range with the efficiency that he can, his
three-level scorer.
Yeah, and he's really come a long way. And adding the three ball where he's now a threat has really opened up the floor for him, I think. I mean, I want to see his passing improve, right? But this is stuff that happens along the way, and you get better players out there. What about Precious Achiuwa? He was awful last year. He was not a good player. And he gave Embiid some work in
Raps
that
culture, baby.
I'm really impressed. His shot has come along. His handle has come along. And for a big, I mean, that's hugely valuable. I think a large part of the reason why Embiid started to look so fatigued the last few games is because of the Precious Achiuwa. Now, it's, you know, they put him in the blender. It was Thad Young. It was everybody. But Precious was really impressive.
Like, yeah, the Raptors have six of the same guy. So
right. It's a creative player. It's a generic creative player. They're all like 6'10 and ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want the strong one in Anunoby? Do you want the ball handling one in Scotty Barnes? Do you want the athletic one in Achiuwa? Yeah.
Basically Ninja Turtles. Yeah. And then another guy I wanted to point out is Tyrese Maxey. And we've been on Maxey for a bit, but man, he was just absolutely great in that series, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, in their wins and their two losses, he was really bad. And part of that has to go to the Raptors and kind of what they did defensively and how they kind of shifted coverage a little bit and slowed him down. But yeah, when Maxey gets downhill, good luck trying to slow him down. Dude, he's fast. Like, it's unbelievable, man. Like, he gets a little bit of space, you're screwed.
He's a better, like, horizontal athlete than vertical. He reminds me a little of sort of early, before he became, like, the ball-dominant guy that he was in Washington, kind of the early career Gilbert Arenas in terms of kind of ability to hit, like, a deep three and then just that – straight line burst from even just a standstill, not even off of like a move, just like a straight line. I'm by you and I'm at the rim and I'm quick shooting it and no one's getting there in time.
Yeah. I mean, it's just lightning quick.
Okay. Now let's go negative. And yeah, there we go.
Yes,
I know.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. I hate to do this. D'Angelo Russell, man. What are we doing here, Seth?
Going to drop 57 tonight.
I know he is. I know. And, hey, okay. I hope so. Because he's been great all year.
This playoffs is crystallizing something for me in terms of, and again, some of this is always framing things in my mind, or not always, but frequently framing things in terms of like where I'm going to slot a guy in the player tier or something like that. But what do you do with guys? Okay, I'm trying to win a championship. I can't trust that guy. And, he's certainly a guy from this that has illustrated why he's on that list. We'll probably get to one or two more over the course of this conversation. But just he's 26. He's been, this is his seventh year in the league. He can't, like, how is he still doing some of the stuff that he does? Like, we talked about it last week where he, you know, in the middle of their big collapse, he decided to, like, a semi-contested three, one on four is a good shot to take. Late game, he says, I'm going to bounce the ball around and barf up like a leaning 19-footer. Like, I'm going to shoot the Chris Paul shot, except I'm not Chris Paul, basically.
All right. I mean, I wasn't sure if you were frozen or not. I mean, it's just frustrating to watch and what you're looking at when you're seeing him in that sense. Like, it's when he's on and he's playing good basketball, it's really good. And you're like, damn, this dude's like, he gets it. But it's on the days where it's like some of the shot selection, and that's a lot of the Wolves too. Anthony Edwards took a terrible shot in that game five down the stretch. Cat barfed up a three just because they gave up a three on one end and things like that. All of that stuff was bad. But when it comes to, like, I want to go to war with this dude, or you know, Russell's just not that guy. He's just not. And it sucks to say it. Like, he's a guy I like having for three quarters, but if I got to play him in the fourth, I'm getting worried.
Has anybody had a worse run the last few months than Donovan Mitchell as far as just in the zeitgeist, like people's opinion? Donovan Mitchell, this playoffs was awful, guys.
I mean, yo, he was god awful. That's not even put it. And it, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but he came into this league a little bit with a defensive profile. Like, he can actually defend some. Like, he looks like he can't defend at all. Like, I feel like I can get by him. And by the way, I shouldn't feel like I can get by anybody that puts on an NBA jersey, even Seth when he wears his Kem Birch jersey. But, like, I feel like wow. I could torch him. And it's just like, I feel like this is one of those things where I don't understand it. Like, I get what he can do scoring wise, and it's all in the paint. He didn't shoot well at all this series, even though he took a series of bad shots. It's like, I just watch him on the defensive end, and it's blow by after blow by after blow by. It's like, when are you going to step up? And they're talking about it inside the NBA. They're saying openly, Jason Kidd's like, yeah, we're going to go at it. And there was no sense of pride or urgency from him. Like, I held him in high standard for a good amount of time. And, you know, like, just watching him kind of fall, at least I was like, all right, well, maybe the season's weird or whatever, this and that. Watching him in the playoffs, I'm just like, damn, man. Like, this is – when you watch the growth and Tatum grow on both ends of the court and the way he's blossoming, and then you look at Donovan Mitchell's, and you're just like, god damn, that's just terrible.
It's not just it's not just on-ball defense. It's off-ball defense. There's something a little, like, Westbrookian about always trying to make sort of the hero play. Like, oh, I'm going to rotate early, and I'm going to jump this pass all the way through the ball behind me to my guy for an open three. Like, there's so much of that. And I don't know. I think my sort of skepticism on Mitchell is well known. And I think that we saw a lot of that this year. Like, there's a fine line. You know, Utah has at times in the playoffs lacked shot creation. So I need to do more. But come on, man. Like, you're talking about, like, okay, you need to do more. Actually get something good. Don't just, like, I'm going to dribble and shoot a pull-up. Like, get something good. Get to the basket. Draw a second defender. Get the ball to somebody else. Don't just, like, oh, I guess I gotta make something happen, so I guess that just means me shooting, whatever. And there's too much of that.
I mean, it's just – it's frustrating in the sense of the – like, I just – if you want to be the dude and you want to be the guy – like, you can't be that bad defensively. You can't be so terrible on that end, right? Like, listen, I'm not asking you to win Defensive Player of the Year. I'm not asking you to be an all-defensive player. I'm just asking you, if you're going to score 30 on one end, don't give up 40 on the other. And I think this is where we're getting with him. And it's like, yo, you need, if you want to be this guy, you got to, the guy you want to say you want to be, you got to do it.
I think Steph Curry is a great example. You know, like, with all the movement that he does on the offensive end, name a defensive possession where you see him take it off. You know, certainly he gambles and he has some risky fouls. That guy competes on defense. I think, Mo, you bring this up a lot. Have some pride. Like, it actually is a pride thing at this point, I think. Anybody else that you guys are down on because of the playoffs? I know it's a small sample, but this stuff does matter.
I know this is not the question you asked, but I'm glad you brought Curry up, just because this is something that I remember wanting to talk about and then forgot to tell you guys I want to talk about is last game, maybe last two games, he looks good physically. Like, he was, you know, maybe again, kind opponent, not a lot of not a lot of perimeter stuff on the other team. Like, Denver's best chance against him was probably Aaron Gordon. But he's got that side-to-side jitterbug thing back that he hasn't necessarily shown in a while. And that's menacing, especially with, you know, some of the guys on Memphis notably Dylan Brooks, who had some success against him in the past. Not kind of going through it a little bit in this series. So they're like, it's not just Memphis has to get through that series. They have to, you know, get right in some ways before they play Golden State.
Well, I'm going to take this opportunity to kind of hammer my guy, Jaren Jackson, because the fouls are bad and the fouls have been a thing. And some of these fouls, I just don't like, he's like, this is a guy who, I don't know, is he feeling the pressure of the moment? He's trying too much, too hard. I don't know what it is. He landed on someone's back the other day. It's just silly stuff. And he fouled out in a game on something that wasn't a foul. But honestly, at this point, if you blow the whistle, he probably fouled just every play.
I mean, it's really ridiculous at this point. Like, when you have a chance to be defensive player of the year when you're on the court, and you just can't stay on the court because you constantly foul. Like, that's something at this point in your career you need to be past. That's a Jackson Hayes type issue and a Jackson Hayes type problem with how far along and it just his time in his career at this point in minutes. This should not be a Jaren Jackson Jr. problem. This shouldn't be something we're talking about with him. Also, same thing goes to Cat for incredibly dumb fouls as well, and further along than even Jaren Jackson Jr. when we talk about it in that sense. So it's like, those are the scenarios with that. It's just surprising sometimes. And it's like, man, now you got me going on a rant. I'm going to sound like Jeff Van Gundy. Like, yo, I'm serious. We got to find these dudes when they complain about calls, when it's very freaking obvious, they completely destroyed the human being they were guarding. Okay. You were all on the guy's arm. And if I see another look of shock in your face that they blew a whistle because they didn't let you dismember somebody, I'm sorry. Like, that should be a fine the next day. Okay. This is ridiculous. It goes with my call for a review and you're clearly wrong. Fine goes to the video room. This one, the league needs to find these dudes because this is ridiculous. You can't act shocked on every single time you hack somebody.
Tim Duncan would never have any money. He would never have any money if Mo has set in the
rules.
Don't
ever bring up St. Timmy in this.
I had John Krasinski on my podcast a couple months ago, and like, we joked, but it might even be true that like, Towns complaining about every call might cost Anthony Edwards free throws. Like, he doesn't get for a player of his sort of athleticism, he doesn't get to the line as much. Some of it's him, but he probably doesn't get the best whistle because the refs are probably too busy telling Carl to shut up. Or like, you know, so, there's a difference between, I think there's a lot of Towns' fouls seem like almost pressing. Like, he is wound very tightly. You can see it. Like, was it game four? He starts the game with the three and he's already like doing like the, you know, the lightning striking me kind of thing. And I don't think that's a show. I think he's just wound very tightly. Right now. And so a lot of these fouls are just like, I got to make something happen, and runs over a guy. Whereas Jackson's are almost more careless, I want to say.
Yeah. And I think that's a fair way of looking at it. But it's like same problem across the board, though, right? Like, guys, keep your composure, find a way to kind of harness this energy in one way. And they just
there's
can't.
One player in this series that has any degree of chill. That's Jordan McLaughlin.
Oh, I was going to say Desmond Bane.
But no, I think it's like that was the amazing, like, Memphis ended up with like, and maybe we can talk about the gamble Anthony Edwards tried, but like the ATO, like, okay, well, we've got Anthony Edwards, we've got D'Angelo Russell, we've got Karl Anthony Towns. Whose hands are we putting whose hands do we trust? What's the safest pair of hands? Jordan McLaughlin. And of course he like runs a play, perfect pass for the open corner three. And it's like, yeah, and I think I actually think that was the right decision because you gave the ball to the calmest man in the gym.
Why are you not, if you're Memphis, fouling as soon as Towns catches the ball with his back to the basket?
We already talked about this. This is the dumbest playoff series that we're going to get this year. Let's just relish in the chaos. The second round of the East is set, and we're going to talk about that after the break.
Spring is the best time to add new challenges to your training, just in time for summer and warmer days. I know I'm looking outside right now. Sun's out, birds are chirping. It's time to start getting outside. I know that I like to get outside and play basketball with my kids, and honestly, I need to get into a fitness routine in order to keep up with these guys. And Peloton is there for me. Peloton's varying class lengths were designed with your training plan in mind. Personalize your workout, whether you'd like to add a 10-minute core session at the end of your strength class, or take a 60-minute power zone ride to increase your endurance. Peloton classes are designed to help focus on your needs and goals. Peloton's classes were made to challenge you. There are a variety of classes like boot camps, boxing, full body strength, or marathon training, all created to grow your skills or push you to improve in what you're already excelling in. Peloton's program and instruction push you to be your best. Their expert coaches and nonstop vibes will push you to new levels of strength and endurance, keeping you on your toes while giving you the professional coaching you need. Peloton has everything you need to get you where you're going. Whether you prefer to run indoors, row or ride at home, or strength train at the gym, Peloton has something for you. Get your head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
I'm going to be calm when I say this, Keith. We are witnessing one of the most delusional athletes in American history. He's lost. Because he's so big on telling everybody else they're lost. Kyrie is also slick. Because he's trying to get away with something that I'm not going to allow him to get away with.
You can try to paint this issue, Kyrie, in anything you want. What it comes down to, and what everybody's going to focus on, you don't want to show up and win. You want to do what you want to do. What you want to do, how you want to do it, why you got your hand out for somebody else's money.
And then when you get called on, we're the peon.
Okay, guys, we're going to start with Celtics and Bucks. And, you know, we mentioned it a little bit earlier. This Chris Middleton injury is massive. And it's massive on both ends. It's not just the offense, man. Who the heck is going to guard Jason Tatum now?
I mean, This is a massive problem for them. There's no way I think the Bucks can win the series without Chris Middleton. Like, that was, I originally had the Bucks winning the series, but that was fully healthy. And even then I was a little bit concerned just because their size along the wing was still kind of small. But now you're going without Middleton. Now you have Grayson Allen out there. Now you have Pat Connaughton. Wesley Matthews isn't known for his size. Like, you're putting out a lot of small wings here, and that's the Celtics. Like, great, we're ready to roll. Like, our smallest guy is what, Marcus Smart in the starting lineup? Like, and he's not small, and he's stocky as all hell. So it's like, I find it to be a very challenging series for Milwaukee defensively. Figuring out who's guarding who and how are we going to just be able to defend and deal with their size and their length, just because they're going to be so damn big.
It's also, I think it's a challenge for both ends, Milwaukee. Like, they're light on ball handling now. Like, that, like, you know, Boston is a handsy, aggressive team, and Drew Holiday can throw the ball around a little bit. And you know, Middleton is a guy who, because of his size and kind of languid ability, can kind of handle pressure a little bit and get you into some stuff. And now who else is handling the ball for Milwaukee? Like I'm worried about them having, you know, them having some turnover issues in this series as well. They were not a deep team, and you know, as you mentioned, the big wing was a lack, and now they have none.
I mean, this is also part of like the shortcomings of, you know, the short-sightedness maybe of the Dante DiVincenzo trade. Not that he's massively big either, but right, like, just another dude to throw out there. It's going to be a real difficult series, I think, for Milwaukee. Not a cakewalk, because, by the way, they still have Giannis. And, you know, if you don't think Tatum's the best player in the playoffs, you better damn sure think it was Giannis. And I think there's some of that with him in the sense of like, well, F it, I'm going, you know, and I'm just going to be a bowling ball through it. And the referees don't call a lot of charges on him. I think, you know, and some might be charges, but it's going to be interesting to see how that goes for him. And you know, see how he kind of goes into the rim, and then he meets Robert Williams coming up from the weak side.
And Robert Williams probably going to be a little healthier than what we saw of Robert Williams against Brooklyn, right? Which, again, works in the Celtics' favor, getting him back in. I mean, this feels like Giannis at the five a lot, which is going to be hard without Middleton. I go, is it, can Brook Lopez play against Robert Williams? Like, what's that going to be?
No, it's tough. I mean, are we asking for predictions on this series? Like, I think it's Celtics in five. I think without Middleton, like they need, like, you know, as you said, they need, you know, probably five because Boston could probably overcome it once. They need five finals game seven level performances from, that's maybe a little too strong because that was kind of an all timer, but they need, you know, 40 and 12 games from Giannis, and they probably need five of them to win four games in this series.
That's not going to be enough. They're going to need Drew Holiday to be unbelievable as well. And I think that's going to be the scenario for them. And, you know, five sounds about right. This is lining up perfect for Boston. And I don't mean this as a slight or anything like that. It takes a lot of luck to win a championship in the NBA. And I never mean that in a negative way. It's just, this is the way this stuff goes. And this is lining up really well for Boston, at least to get to the conference finals, which is something I didn't think was on the table. Even a month ago, I thought, hey, Milwaukee is going to beat them. Like, I was confident in that with Middleton and everything. But now it's just, you see it going, and it's just like, I just can't see a way for Milwaukee to defend them and to score on them. The margin of error is so freaking low. They're going to need phenomenal performances from Bobby Portis, from Lopez. Like, these dudes are going to have to shoot the hell out of the ball all series long. You know, Grayson Allen's going to have to knock down three threes a night without being an idiot on the other end of the court. And I don't know if he's possible doing that.
I'm just wondering, against Boston's defense, how they get those shots for those guys. Like, yeah. Boston's so good about, you know, their switching, reswitching, hedging, recovery, like that, like just shrinking space and not allowing those shots.
Their off-ball scram switches, switch outs and things like that are so precise and perfectly timed. Like, it's on another level. You know, it's something that, like, every time I watch it, it's, you know, I'm like, ooh, there it is. Did you see it? I love it. You know, and I don't even care if the other team scored on the possession, but it's, they just do such a great job of getting themselves out of bad matchups, which is, by the way, only when Peyton Pritchard's on the court.
But he's great at it. He's able to function as, like, you know, a seventh, eighth, ninth guy for them because he can communicate and get himself out of those bad situations.
It's perfect. I mean, like, if you go back to that Phoenix New Orleans game last night, that, you know, the big Booker three on the wing is because they were trying to organize a second scram switch, trying to get CJ McCollum off of DeAndre Ayton, and it pulled Herb Jones off Booker by a step, and Chris Paul sends it immediately to Book, who drills that huge three. But it's like, it's that kind of, it's one step, guys. I'm telling you, in the NBA, in the playoffs, one step, half a second, whatever it is, you got to be almost perfect. And right now, Boston is just at that level. Like, I'm just blown away by it.
So, this is a tangent, but to illustrate Mo's point about how important that one step is a couple of years ago, we did a study using the tracking data of how teams give up corner threes. And what we found is the difference between where the player who's closing to the corner started for the team that gave up the most corner threes and the team that gave up the least was about 2 feet on average. So, like, about a step. Like, got the teams that gave up the most, their guy was starting like one step, three quarter step closer to the basket, and they couldn't get there. Whereas the team that was best, like, was that extra step allowed them to close out and take that shot away.
I have a question for you on that study for later.
And speaking of some injury luck, if you're the Miami Heat, you probably feel pretty lucky. Joel Embiid has that torn ligament in his thumb. Clearly hampered by it, guys. I mean, I don't think any of us watched those games, especially the last couple, and couldn't tell that something was bothering him. Feels like a really nice potential series for Miami if Embiid is going to struggle.
Well, I think there's some of it on Miami side too. You have Kyle Lowry with a little bit of a hamstring issue. Not sure what's going on there. Jimmy Butler out game five with the knee inflammation. Like, they got a little bit of concerns themselves in terms of what they have. And I mean, I think this is going to be a wild series in the sense of just battles. Bam versus Embiid. And Embiid's not shooting the three ball well, but I don't think he was shooting the three ball that well before even the thumb injury in the Toronto series. So I think, like, it'll be very interesting to watch that stuff, Kyle Lowry and things like that. It's going to come down maybe to, can Tyler Hero not be such a big target at the end of games? And I think that's something Miami's got to look at. And they got to find a way to take advantage of not just Harden, but Maxey on the defensive end for them to really make it work.
So Miami got through the series, but in a series where he should have ate, like, Bam was just kind of okay. And that's, you know, and we talked about the success that Toronto had kind of spreading Embiid out and going at him. Like, at his best, Bam can facilitate some of that. They need him to be better if they're going to do that in this series. So I, like, this is a very, like, I don't, I, this is a very interesting one. I've been skeptical of Miami as a playoff team for a lot of the reasons we talked about. I mean, you just mentioned it, like the fact that their offensively viable lineups have defensive targets, but it's not like Philly has their own sort of foibles. And this is two like high upside, but kind of flawed teams going at each other. And it'll be interesting to see game to game how those matchups kind of play out, who gets the upper hand in any given game.
How does Miami win? What does it look like? Like, if Miami wins this in six, let's say they win it. I think you win in six. You won that series pretty handily to me. What do they need to do to win in five or six games? Like, what does that look like?
I think for starters is they keep the Sixers out of transition and slow them down. You know, my thing for Philly is when they play fast in the half court, and just to clarify, that doesn't mean quick shots in the shot clock. It means quick movements and actions and getting into your stuff quicker and earlier and things like that. I think that if Miami can get them to slow down and they can win this series, because then James Harden goes into dribble, dribble, dribble for 25 seconds and shoots. And yes, I purposely said 25 seconds. And then, you know, if you get them to push out the offense and get them starting the offense in the half court, or, you know, right at like the half court line, you open up more advantages for them, because I think they're quicker in their rotations. Those guys fly around the court really well. They got a ton of defenders on the court there. I think they got to kind of make it a little bit more of a rock fight. And I think that's how Miami wins. It's all about how they play it on the defensive end, and if they can get Philly to play slow.
So, Seth, how do they keep Tyler Hero off James Harden? Right? Because doesn't that feel like that's going to be the matchup that Philly's going for? And if James Harden can get going, that's a problem.
Well, the first thing they can do is fight through screens, not this is not
this is the NBA set.
This is not a soft switch series for Miami, put it that way. Like maybe it's kind of a jump and hedge and recover, because who's, like, you know, that's an interesting, like, aspect is who, if they're trying to use like the screen to get the screen, like, who's Hero covering that you are totally worried about on like slip out for popping, like, you know, if it's like, is Hero going to end up on Niang? Like, if it's Matisse Thybulle, do you care? Like, you know, so who is that guy that is setting the screen for Harden, and can they find a lineup where that actually puts Miami in distress? And that'll be interesting to see.
And the funny thing is, if they match up too hard on that, you're taking away what I think is one of Philly's better weapons, besides the post up to Embiid, is the James Harden Embiid pick and roll. Right. And then what that does, and it's not just for those two guys, what that does for Maxey on the second side is really the key to it. And again, so like, if they're going to sit there and go, hey, we're going to throw Thybulle into these screens to get Hero switched on to James, and then we're going to run our offense, that's more time. You know, and then if Hero can avoid the first switch and then switches on the second one, more time running off the clock. There's almost even a win in that, even if they switch onto him in the second time. But it took time off the clock, and they're still playing slower. And I think that's going to be something that, like, Philly can fall into that trap a little bit too much. And it's, you know, the over matchup hunting can be an issue, because then you just stay zeroed in on this, and if it's not fruitful, you're putting yourself in a bad spot there. And I think that's something Philly's got to be mindful of.
I think that the thing to you know how if you have a soccer game on and you're sort of half watching, you can get a sense for how the game is going just by where's the camera, like what part of the field is the game being played in. I think a little bit we'll see that, like you mentioned it, where's Philly's offense? When Toronto was doing well in that series, like, Philly's offense was five out with like three guys up above the hash mark and, you know, way out from the basket. And when they were, you know, space is good, but you know, you do need to crack the defensive shell and get the ball inside those areas. So that on one end, like, where's Philly running their offense? If they're running it at half court, it's advantage Miami. If the ball is constantly in or around the paint, it's advantage Philly. I think that's going to be a big determining factor of this series, because if Philly can score, I don't think Miami can score with them. But if it's a rock fight, I think that Miami has more kind of what's the best way of describing it? Like those kind of random ball bounce to someone, make a play. I think Zach Lowe once described it as Jimmy Butler's playing gully ball. And I think that's what we're talking about here.
Well, it's a matchup of two top 15 coaches of all time, Mo. You know, this is
in the league now.
This is what we've all been waiting for. Yes. We've been waiting for this sort of chess match from a coaching perspective. I mean, look, Eric Spoelstra, if he's not the best coach in the league, he's the second best coach in the league. I think we agree that he's at least one or two. That's a huge advantage for Miami, Mo.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you guys know how critical I am of Doc,
yeah,
and all of those things. No, because you set it up that way to do it. But I think Spo is just a great coach, and I'm not trying to take that away from Doc. I mean, I think the situation is, though, like, Spo has these guys and understands really what he needs from them and how to get there. Doc, and this is a little bit tough for Doc in the scenario, and for any coach, he's still trying to figure out this team. I mean, they made a massive trade, added a massive piece in James Harden in February, and you're still trying to put things together. And that's just a time component that, you know, the advantage that Spo has that Doc doesn't. And I think that's something that we don't talk about enough, but it is an issue and it's a challenge. And sometimes we criticize these guys, especially me, but we got to also look at some of the stuff that they got to deal with.
It's a little bit illustrative of organizational philosophy as well. Like, it's not an accident that Miami has like compliant guys like up and in their roster, and you know, and Philly goes like indexes like straight talent. You know, so you have part of getting a guy like Harden is he has ideas about how he wants to play, and maybe you can shade that, but he's going to play the way he's going to play. And that's, you know, and that's always, you know, that is always a challenge for coaching in the NBA, is because the best players are empowered to do that at times. And not everyone is Tim Duncan, or no one else is Tim Duncan, like literally, obviously, but who will like coach me however, and I'll do it. That's much less common than, you know, having to actually convince a guy and mold a guy more than just having him be able to like respond to command like you would expect a college team to.
Do we think that Harden will be more aggressive than he was in the last series? I mean, you know, Embiid kind of complained about it and said it was more of a coaching issue, which, to Mo's point, you know, you're dealing with personalities here, and do we think that Harden can be more aggressive? Because that's what Philly needs, I think.
Who do we think Miami starts on him? Do you think they just go PJ Tucker?
Yeah, I think they go PJ Tucker. I think the fun thing is putting like Jimmy Butler on Tyrese Maxey or something like that and slowing him down a little bit. Or, you know, depends what's going on with Lowry on Maxey, and then you put Jimmy on Tobias. You know, I think that's the stuff you can kind of – they can play around with matchups. They have a lot of guys to throw at Jimmy – excuse me, at James Harden. And I think that's something that can tire him out because it's also different types of guys, right? Jimmy's going to play defense differently than PJ. PJ's going to be a lot more physical, not – you know, and a lot more in you and handsy and things like that. And I think – you know, and some of that's going to come down to also how it's officiated. And that's going to be an important thing there to look at is can PJ get to be that physical with him? And I think that's going to be interesting. But I think you start out with PJ on him and go from there. I think that's because even then when you switch to pick and roll, PJ on Embiid, although Embiid has the massive size, PJ's strong. He's not just going to get straight run over. And I think that's something that they got to be aware of.
So is this a 7-game series to you guys?
I think I'm actually leaning Miami in 6.
Seth, is that you kind of the same? I know it's such know, it's, a, it feels it, like a toss up.
It's it also is, the I mean the Lowry's availability and his like that is because Miami is you know you start to get into their backcourt and unless Victor Oladipo is gonna like be continue to be a thing and we haven't even talked about that like where did that come from, but. You know, all of a sudden you're getting into your, you know, your Gabe Vincents and your Max Strus's. And, you know, Gabe Vincent has done some things in the playoffs. Max Strus has done some things in the playoffs. But we're getting to the point where are we really expecting those guys to be 25, 30 minute a game players in like the second round of the playoffs?
I think Strus is. I don't know about the other guys.
To be fair, this is a reasonable matchup for him because you can stick him on Thibault. You can stick him on Yang. You can probably get away with him on Harris if they're running their offense elsewhere. So, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's it. The Oladipo thing to me is if everybody's healthy, I don't think you'll see a lot of Oladipo.
Yeah.
Unless you like, yo, we need a spark. Go. Type situation. And if you're in that situation – yeah. You're probably
things are bad.
Going
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I guess you made me pick right now, I'd say Heat in 7.
Oof. I don't know. It's gonna be fun. I'm really curious to see. I want to see more out of Bam. I just like you. I really thought that could have been a big series for him against Atlanta, and I think he needs a big series against Embiid. I think it'll be important for the Heat. You guys got anything else before we go?
Let's go with this. I'm irrationally excited and preemptively annoyed for game 6 of Memphis, Minnesota.
Oh, it's like, I'm just going to say it right now. Like we're hours away from this game being started. I'm pretty sure the game has already shown up at a bar and is taking shots. It's going to be drunk by the time tip off begins. Like it's not even like it's already kicked back a few at this point right now. Like I'm excited to see what colossal mess that game could possibly be. And it'll be fun.
I think Memphis wins this series in 7. And I think that it's going to end up being that Minnesota will feel like they should have won 6 of the games.
Is Ja going to get another big dunk tonight? That's what I'm really curious about.
I mean, the sky blue?
Good grief, man. He just goes to work trying to ruin somebody's week all the time. That's going to do it for this week, folks. Keep it locked into the Athletic NBA show for the rest of the playoffs. Got the Saturday Slam and Jam coming up tomorrow. For Seth and Mo, I'm Dave. Thanks for listening to Nerder, She Wrote, on the Athletic NBA show.
This is Nerder, She Wrote, with your host, Dave Dufour.
With Mo DeKeel.
And Seth Partnow.